Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, we've been looking back at some of the biggest stories of 2015 in sports, in medicine, and criminal justice, and through the perspectives of some of our favorite guests. Today, let's talk about the movies, songs, and television that had the biggest cultural impact of the year, beginning with music from Adele, whose new album 25 sold more than 3 million copies in its first week. To Kendrick Lamar's huge song, All Right, which became an anthem for the Black Lives Matter movement. And when I wake up, I recognize you're looking at me for the pay cut. But I'm gonna stop looking at you for the face down. We'll make 11. Well, joining us now to look back on the year in pop culture is Renee Graham, op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe and former pop culture columnist and critic for the Globe as well. Renee, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
I'm doing great, and happy New Year's Eve in 2016 to you.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, let's talk about Kendrick Lamar. And before we do so, I'd love to hear a little bit more of All Right. It was just such a huge and important song this year. So, Renee, this song really sort of captured the voice and became a song of one of the most important political movements in the country this year, the Black Lives Matter movement. Tell us about All Right and about Kendrick Lamar's import this year.
You know, everyone was waiting for this album. The album was called To Pimp a Butterfly. And the first single was All Right. And it came out right in the middle of this moment when the Black Lives Matter movement was really on the rise. He didn't write it for the movement. The movement, it became sort of a spontaneous anthem, but it just worked. And he understood the moment. And he really captured the energy, the angst, you know, but also the sense that, you know, we're going to be all right. We're going to get through this. That was the thing. It was affirming. Yeah. It wasn't just, oh, my God, look how bad things are. The idea was, we're going to be all right. And in its way, it was as sort of provocative and important as, say, Dylan's Blowing in the Wind or Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So there's the combination of affirmation, but also unflinching truth about the politics of the moment, because he does sing in the song about you said angst, but I'd even take it so far as anger about how many African Americans just look at law enforcement officers and see all those police related shootings and wonder who's against who and what the clash is in society. He doesn't shy away from any of that.
He doesn't. You know, there's no half-stepping with Kendrick Lamar. You know, he's not afraid to be political. He's not trying to sugarcoat anything. And he understands his audience. You know, he knows who he's speaking to, and he knows that they're going to understand exactly what he's saying. You know, in another way, the song reminds me of, you know, the old hymn, you know, We Shall Not Be Moved. You know, there's a lot of that, too. There's a lot of defiance. You know, not violence, but a lot of defiance that we're on the side of the angels here, and you're going to hear us out, and we're going to be heard, and we're going to be all right. And I think that was very important at a time when it seemed like, you know, so many unarmed young black men were getting killed. It was important for people to say, we're going to be all right, but we're not going to be all right just standing on the sidelines. We're going to be all right because we're going to be engaged in what is going on.
So your analogy to Nina Simone and Mississippi Goddamn really got me thinking, because we've got some tape here of Kendrick Lamar's recent interview with NPR's David Greene. And he told David Greene that he wants to change the world. Lamar tells him that, but that first he really has to deal with his own emotion, his own anger about the world as he finds it. And he told David Greene about his friend Chad Keaton, who was shot and killed this past summer in a drive-by shooting in Compton. So let's listen to what he said.
I can't change the world until I change myself first. For instance, when Chad was killed, I can't disregard the emotion of me relapsing and feeling the same anger that I felt when I was 16, 17, when I wanted the next family to hurt because you made my family hurt. Them emotions were still running in me, thinking about him being slain like that. Whether I'm a rap star or not, if I still feel like that, then I'm part of the problem rather than the solution.
Renee, how important is it that an eloquent, talented musical voice like that is capturing those feelings now for, you know, for 2015?
Well, I think it's twofold. I mean, I think that, you know, you always get music that comes out of it. But as I said, this was music he wrote before the Black Lives Movement really took root. So he already sensed what was going on there. I think what also impresses me about Kendrick Lamar is that so much of it is personal, in the same way that Nina Simone's music was personal.
Deeply personal.
Deeply
yeah.
personal. But also in the way that he writes it, he's not an observer. He's a participant. He's not separating himself from the people in the streets and what they're concerned about and what they want to talk about. And I think that's what really connects with people with what he does.
Yeah. So there's so much to talk about regarding this intersection between politics, pop culture, and the personal as well. And we see it in a different medium altogether, in television, like in Scandal, right? Because in the most recent season of Scandal, the Shonda Rhimes show, of course, a police officer shoots a young black man in the streets of Washington, D.C. And we have a scene from the show here where professional fixer Olivia Pope, played by Kerry Washington, of course, tries to convince the police chief not to disband people from the neighborhood who have gathered by the crime scene.
There is a dead child lying in the street in front of their homes. What would you do if there was a dead child, a child you knew, lying in the street in front of your home? The fact that they stand in groups and say things you do not like does not make them a mob. It makes them Americans.
So, Renee, tell me what you think about Scandal taking up this particular storyline.
You know, there were some arguments. Some people felt, well, are you trivializing it by putting it into a TV show? And I thought, no. I thought what was important about what TV shows were doing with what was happening is they were engaging the news. And I think it also spoke a lot to who's making these TV shows. When you're talking about Shonda Rhimes with Scandal, you had a lot of that coming up in Empire as well, which is co-created by Lee Daniels. You know, these are successful black people who are still connecting to what's happening in the news. And I think that's why it was important to put it out there. I think it's absurd to think that creative people can watch the news and completely separate themselves from what's going on and say, but we're going to continue to put on our nice little fantasy land. The point is that, you know, this is what's happening. They want to be current and they want to be real.
Yeah.
And I think it took, you know, a great deal of nerve to put these issues in these TV shows.
Is there a risk, though, for television shows for, because they move fast, a little faster than movies, I'd say, for music, in the attempt to be real and in the moment, in the same sort of emotional and political space as listeners or watchers, is there a risk, though, there that, you know, perhaps they're also trivializing the moment?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, you know, less so Scandal, but much more so Empire, because Empire is such a campy show in its own way. So when you had the character Cookie Lyons saying, you know, if I die in police custody, it's not suicide, obviously she was referencing the death of Sandra Bland in Texas, but people kind of felt, because the show is so jokey, that they didn't want it to become a punchline. These issues were way too important to trivialize.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Empire, since you've mentioned it a couple times. It's a show about a hip-hop entertainment company owned by a character named Lucius Lyon, who's trying to decide which one of his three sons is going to take over control of the company. And here we've got a scene where Lucius Lyon, played by Terrence Howard, explains to a boardroom full of executives why music is so important to him. This is from Empire's pilot episode.
I started selling drugs when I was 9 years old in Philadelphia. I did it to feed myself. But it was the music that played in my head that kept me alive when I thought I was going to get shot. And it was the melodies that I dreamt about that kept me warm while I was sleeping in the streets.
So tell me more about why you loved Empire.
It came out of nowhere in this sort of strange way. I mean, after 30 years of hip hop, suddenly you have a TV show about, you know, this hip hop empire. And it was weird. It was campy. It employed a lot of music. It was very, very loosely based on Shakespeare's King Lear. But it was just sort of all over the place. I mean, it wasn't afraid to be ridiculous. It's a soap opera. It's a hip hop soap opera. You know, and the storylines are that ridiculous and the characters are that overblown, none more so than Taraji P. Henson as the great Cookie Lyon. You watch that show to see what Cookie was going to say and to see what Cookie was going to wear. That was the point. You know, it fell off a little bit in its second season, but that, when it came on in January, it was the biggest show on TV instantly.
Wow, yeah. You know, TV in all its forms, whether it's broadcast cable or online, has been having some pretty good years. And I think 2015, I'd add among them, because I was a little late to the table in watching Master of None, but I caught up pretty quickly. I binged watched Aziz Ansari's Netflix show, and I thought it was terrific. So let's talk about that a little bit here. We've got a clip here from the first season finale, and if you haven't, I know we have to say this in this day and age, if you haven't yet seen it, even though all 13 episodes are available online, spoiler alert, we're playing a clip from the season finale of Master of None, so plug your ears. So here we have Aziz Ansari and his girlfriend Rachel, played by Noelle Wells, talking about dating cross-racially.
What is the real race breakdown of your previous dates?
White, 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 half Asian, and you.
Whoa, so that half Asian guy, he was kind of a gateway drug to me?
I guess so. Who knows what'll be next?
I do. White guy.
So, Renee, I have to say, one of the things I liked about Master of None actually harkens back to something you were saying earlier. It was, I mean, it's fiction, it's television, but it sort of treated issues like interracial dating in a really real way that didn't pretend to be more than it really was, but yet that made it so much to me.
You know, you can have conversations about serious subjects that sound like the ways that real people have these conversations. And that is how people talk about these things. You know, it isn't all sort of scripted and easy. It is this sort of weird and not simplistic, but this really plain spoken way of dealing with each other. And I think that's, you know, what shows like that were really good at. And I think shows like that are to some degree better at doing it than sometimes the network shows are, you know. And I think what's been interesting about shows like Master of None is, you know, it's part of this incredible emergence of Netflix, which everyone knows from, you know, the red envelopes and getting DVDs, as essentially being a network.
That's right.
You know, some of the best shows this year were on Netflix. So you had Jessica Jones, and you had Daredevil, and you had Master of None. You know, and just in recent weeks, you've had Making a Murderer, has been this 10-part documentary that's had people absolutely riveted, you know, just sort of binge-watching all of these shows and then discussing them. You know, this is all happening on Netflix. This isn't happening on HBO. This isn't happening on Fox. And I think that's been a really interesting thing about some of these shows. There's a whole new way of watching these shows, and you're getting storylines you might not necessarily get on the networks.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking a lot about shows that are very much in the now and the moment, but we can't wrap up this conversation without at least doing a little hat tip to the end of Mad Men, which was definitely not about the now in any way, shape, or form.
No.
After 7 seasons, I mean, what did you think about the conclusion of the series?
You know, I'll admit it, I was never the biggest fan of Mad Men. I tried with that show. I really, really did. I think of it as being essentially an ode to sexism, 3 martini lunches, and mid-century design.
I did get a little tired of the serial philandering,
You know, it's like, it just seemed to be running in place for me a little bit. But, however, Mad Men was an interesting show in that it was always a bigger critical hit than it was a commercial hit. And I always thought it was a big hit on the coast, maybe not as much in the middle parts of the country. And I think in that way it was very influential because it was big in L.A. and big in New York and some of the bigger cities. But it did have this kind of influence in, you know, the way people dressed and the way people thought. But I think it also played with the idea that things haven't improved as much as we think they have.
Mm-hmm.
There's still sexism. There's still this kind of, you know, weird jockeying in corporate America between men and women. I think it was very good at portraying that, but also acknowledging the fact that we haven't progressed nearly as much as we think we have.
Yeah. So in the last minute that we have here, Renee, I've really enjoyed this conversation because I think that there's really fertile ground for talented and creative producers of content, whether it's music or television or movies. Getting back to what we were talking about earlier about really reflecting our current present as it is through their various mediums. Do you think that we're going to see this trend continue of very little time passing before politics and events happen, and then we see some sort of interpretation of that in pop culture?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no reason for it not to. There's so many outlets and ways to do it. You don't have the structure where it's like, I'm coming to think about this and we can get a TV show on in 6 months. You can get something up on YouTube tonight. You can make a song and get it out to people immediately. And I think that's what's really interesting about this period is because you can capture things so quickly and process them and get them out to people in a very different way. You don't have to wait and go through the more traditional channels to do that. So I think absolutely we're going to continue to see more and more of that.
Yeah. You know, we didn't even talk about Adele, but, you know, she sold 3 million albums, like, in just a couple days.
She's up to 7 million.
Seven million now.
She doesn't even need us to talk about her.
Well, Renee Graham is an opinion columnist for the Boston Globe and a frequent guest here at Radio Boston. Renee, thank you so much for coming in, and a very happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's more of the show coming up in just a minute. This is Radio Boston.